Now for agribusiness news, markets, and weather from Studio C, this is Agriculture Today.
We've had a number of successes with India over the past year.
Chief Ag Negotiator with the USTR, Doug McCallum.
During President Modi's state visit to Washington this summer, India agreed to remove retaliatory tariffs on certain U.S. agricultural products, including chickpeas, lentils, almonds, walnuts, and apples, among other products. The removal of the retaliatory tariffs will restore market opportunities for these U.S. products, many of whom are small and family-owned farming operations. This was following an agreement with India earlier this year to reduce tariffs on turkey, duck, cranberries, and blueberries. India this year reduced its pecan tariff by 70% on imports, following robust government-to-government engagement in February.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
Succession planning is really a process. It's not a one-time event. It's not something that you do one time, put it in the bottom drawer of the filing cabinet, and say, yep, I have a plan, and I never have to look at it again.
That's Brendan Dirkschneider, president of Insurance Design Management, on succession planning.
Because every time that Congress or Senate goes into session and they start changing laws, or the family dynamics change, or family members change, that succession plan needs to get updated. But not only that, succession planning is really a process. And it's a process of identifying and developing the new leaders who are going to replace the older generation when they either decide that they want out, they want to retire, or maybe they become disabled, or they, as we all will, die and leave the operation. And in a family business, that can be difficult because a lot of times we treat that younger generation more as a hired hand rather than a leader or the next generation of leaders. So we really need to focus in on that mentoring process to really to help the next generation fulfill those key business roles and leadership positions. And within the operation, help them understand the why, help them understand why we make the decisions that we make, how we've gotten to the point of where we're at, and what decisions need to be made to help keep the family business in force or continue to grow the operation over the next decades to come.
We've all heard of probate and the horror stories, but he says that can be avoided.
You can avoid probate in a couple of different manners. You can avoid probate by how you title property. So if you own property jointly with rights of survivorship, so if a husband and wife own a house or a farm or another asset, it's a title joint tenants with rights of survivorship, at the death of that first individual, the asset automatically flows to the surviving spouse. You can pass assets by a beneficiary designation. A beneficiary designation actually supersedes what an estate planning document states. So you may say that, you know, you want your children to get your life insurance death benefits, or you want your children to get your IRAs because maybe your spouse doesn't need them. But if you don't complete your beneficiary designations correctly, it will, whoever you listed as your primary beneficiary, that's who those assets are going to go to, even if your estate planning documents say something different. We have transfer on death deeds or payable on death accounts, which will automatically pass those assets or those accounts to whoever that transfer on death deed names, or you can give it away during your lifetime. And there's nothing wrong with the aspects of giving away gifts during your lifetime if you're financially independent and you don't need those assets. You give those away today, your beneficiaries have complete ownership and the right to use some of those assets. And with some of our farm operators, that may make sense. That next generation may need to be building their net worth. They may need to be building their lending capital or their working capital. So what's the pros and cons of making lifetime gifts? Otherwise, we have to use a trust. And using a trust is a very valuable tool when it comes to succession planning.
Let's move from succession to just tax. Trump tax cuts, the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, if that's not extended, there will be five key points for individuals beginning in 2026. One, tax rates will increase. Those in the 12% bracket will see 25%. Standard deduction cut pretty much in half. Child tax credit goes from $2,000 to $1,000. Penalty for not getting government health insurance is restored. And the estate tax exemption cut moves from 14 to 7 million. It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
I am pleased that this committee is not directed against China, but is directed against the Chinese Communist Party in the crafting of the language.
So earlier this year, the House created a select committee on the strategic competition between the U.S. and China Communist Party. Ro Khanna is a representative Democrat from California.
And I am pleased that it's going to focus on things that have been a bipartisan concern. Human rights violations that Representative McGovern has advocated in standing up to the Uyghurs. The fact that this country has lost our industrial base for 40 years on a bipartisan basis, we watched as jobs were shipped offshore, factories shut down, our trade deficits going from $70 billion to almost $400 billion. That has hurt the working class. It's hurt our ability to be a superpower, and it has led to rising tensions with China. If we want to deal with Asian hate in this country, one of the things we need to do is rebalance our production. It's the loss of our jobs that has fueled some of the xenophobia. It's the loss of those jobs that fueled the killing that Representative Chu talked about in Michigan with Vincent Chang. I believe this committee can not only stand up for American interests, I believe when done well, it can help get us to peace and reduce the tensions with China by rebalancing trade, by ensuring that China doesn't invade Taiwan, and by standing up for human rights.
French Hill is a Republican from Arkansas.
The title is fundamental here. This is a policy dispute between our government and the Chinese Communist Party. Not China, not the Chinese people. Most Americans have great affinity for the Chinese people, their industriousness, technical talent, both in China and as citizens abroad. And the United States has a long history of partnership with China in the 19th century as a partner in trade, during World War II as an ally, and our support of their growth over the past five decades. But today, as a great power and as an ancient civilization, China has been perverted by the modern leadership of Leader for Life, Xi, and the CCP. Sadly, this has been manifested by rampant intellectual property theft, overburdening developing nations through corrupt credit practices, manipulation of the facts in Wuhan, punishment of religious thought, and the collapse of the rule of law in one of the freest places on the globe, Hong Kong, and perhaps most offensively, genocide of the Uyghurs and others. During the pandemic, we have witnessed the severe vulnerability of the world's global supply chain as being far too reliant on China for minerals, for pharmaceuticals, for medical supplies, for almost everything. This select committee will work to address the possible strategies and meet and counter Xi's posture.
Michael Waltz is a representative from Florida.
We have the cornering of critical supply chains and dependencies on China that is being done deliberately as they steal their way to the top through our intellectual property, spying on the Federal Reserve, flooding our key institutions, including academia, with money, buying up farmland. Mr. Chairman, this is a whole of government, whole of society challenge that we have never before faced in American history.
And this is Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
When I first started in this job, one of the first meetings I had was we were told by the agricultural community, do no harm. Greg, that's what we want you to do. Do no harm. I think we've come a long way since that first meeting. We've made a lot of changes. Made a huge upgrade on 47% of our ag exports in those four countries.
Before becoming the CEO of the National Milk Producers Federation, Greg Dowd was the chief ag negotiator with the U.S. Trade Representative.
So whether it's the bipartisan message we have now in the new template on USMCA, whether it's the 50 things that we've already changed with China, and what hopefully we can accomplished going forward there. You know, on those 50 things, I have to digress and stop and tell you, you know, Sarah, how many in our years in Washington, how many of these strategic and economic dialogues and blah, 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 blah we had with China. And I'm not being partisan here. It was both administrations. Long history of that. Both sides of the aisle working with China. And if you had one thing, there was a huge press release, declared victory, and then what did you do? You went home. Nothing ever happened. One thing. Folks, we've made 50 changes now in just the last few months. I hope people can really understand and appreciate the changes that we've made with China and what that means going forward. We're just getting started there. We're just getting started. What we've done with Japan, I know, you know, in Japan, I've heard since I've been in this job, Greg, well, why just TPP? We just want TPP. Well, we talked about the bipartisan vote for USMCA, but on the other side of that, you'd never had a vote in Congress on TPP. Why? Because it would have never passed. And I want folks in the agricultural community to understand, you have a lot of folks that say, well, we wanted TPP. Yeah, you wanted it, but it was never going to happen. You didn't have the votes in Congress to pass it. So the fact that we now have a deal with Japan, and we went away from Congress to get that done, to me, is truly remarkable. And the four countries here and the changes that we've made and how were we able to accomplish that. It has been a part of history the last 2.5 years. We've made some history in agricultural trade. We've made some unprecedented changes, things we've dreamed of for years, and it's flown by. And I just want to close with this, is it's been an absolute pleasure to be in this job. When you work at USTR, folks, these are the best of the best. These folks are absolutely amazing. They're dedicated. When we were doing that deal with Canada and Mexico, when we were doing the deal with Japan, had colleagues and coworkers that literally slept on their couches in their offices overnight to get things done. And I know during the implementation side of this, you had folks at USDA working nights and weekends to get this done. What I want you to know is that it's not by accident. We have a guy in my boss, and Ambassador Lighthizer is probably one of the great trade representatives of all time. And he is a tough, tough guy to work for. I can assure you that there's a guy tougher to work for as well, and that's his boss.
Greg Dowd, who served as Chief Ag Negotiator with the U.S. Trade Representative, now CEO, National Milk Producers. It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
I have a pretty good feel for what's really going to happen with net farm income at this point in time, but I really concentrate on our KFMA grain farms.
Greg Ibendahl is a farm management specialist with Kansas State.
So the KFMA, Kansas Farm Management Association, data is really the backbone that goes into this, as well as looking at my projection for prices and yields. But I use the KFMA data to get a lot of the expenses from. So basically, we take that data, and we have a pretty good idea of what things are going to be. So we basically plug that into a model, and I can look at really what I think is going to happen with net farm income for the coming year. So like I said, we have an idea for prices and yields at this point in time. We use 2022 KFMA farms really to get an idea for the expenses. I kind of update those based on what has happened during the year. So I have an idea what happened last year with fertilizer, obviously, but as the year goes on, I have a new projection with I can plug in the current fertilizer prices to see how that paid out. I also have to accommodate for the fact that there could be some idea of farmers buying their expenses earlier and then maybe not expensing it till next year. What, you know, farmers doing cash-based accounting, they can really buy stuff earlier and then account it in this year where it may not show up really from an accrual perspective in the next year. So looking at those kind of things, that's how I kind of go about getting all the expenses in and kind of updating my model as I go. I think I was pretty pessimistic back in February. I think I still showed up overall average profit, but it has since really kind of increased quite a bit. So, you know, there's been a few bad things happening during the course of the year. Certainly grain prices have went down over what I first thought they were going to be. But that's really kind of counter offset by the fact that I think crop insurance payments are going to probably be higher than what they would have originally because of those lower grain prices. So I factor that in there. I also factor in what the yields are going to be. So yields are probably going to be a little higher than what we first thought. You know, the wheat yield didn't actually turn out to be quite as bad as what they thought. I think we ended up with about 32 to 35 yield for the state. Now, again, that's a lot of wheat acres didn't get harvested. So we have a better idea for that. And then I have a final number for the crop insurance numbers too. So there are going to be some payouts if you have the right kind of base anyway out in western Kansas, especially for corn. So that kind of helps out in the revenue side. Really, the revenue side hasn't really declined that much over what I first saw. I think the big benefit actually is expenses have gone down quite a bit over what they were first projected to be. At one point last fall, I think, fertilizer for anhydrous was like $1,500 a ton. You know, really, it's probably less than half that now. Now, the big question is how much of that improvement in fertilizer is actually going to show up this year? I know a lot of farmers probably bought their spring fertilizer back last fall, but there's still going to be some farms, I think, that took advantage of that, especially for the wheat production this fall. I think farmers are going to see some advantage if they apply fertilizer to get that going. So there is going to be some cost reduction this year. Again, some of that may not really show up till next year, but when you take the combination of the fact that we had probably pretty even revenue for this year compared to last year with the fact that expenses are going down, I think we're definitely going to see an improvement in that regard. And even though I don't have very many livestock farms in my mix, I'm basically just looking at the KFMA grain farms. There is some livestock farms that show up in those mix, and really there's a big improvement on the livestock side, so that'll help as well. I think the overall picture is we're probably looking at probably better net farm income this year than we had last year. I think I'm looking at probably about an average of about $150,000 to $70,000 or so, depending if you're talking about the median or the mean value. Again, there's a little difference between how you calculate those. Some of the better farms tend to bring up our average. But really, last year, this 2022 wasn't a total disaster. I mean, it may look that way if you look at it over the last 5 to 7 years, but really from a historical perspective, you go back and look at 20 years, really 2022 net farm income was probably above average. I think this year in 2023 will be above that. So really an improvement for most farms. If I look at the number of farms that actually probably have negative net farm income, which is really what we're kind of looking at the tails of our distribution. Really, in 2022, we probably had about 10% of our farms that had negative net farm income. I really think in 2023, we're probably looking at a very similar case, so not too many farms that are going to be in trouble. Really an overall improvement. Now, the situation certainly gets different when we get to 2024.
It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
The other thing we need to think about is expired CRP grass.
Drew Ricketts is a wildlife extension specialist at Kansas State.
Because that's a really important component of nesting cover for lesser prairie chickens in the area where they're most abundant. So expired CRP that has been cropland within the last 5 years would be included under normal agricultural practices and most likely could be broken back out and would not be considered incidental take in that way.
So how do grazing plans work with the 4D rule?
One of the provisions of the 4D rule is that if there is a grazing plan in place that has been approved by an approved plan developer, then we are entirely covered for incidental take. So what that would mean is we don't have to worry about ramifications if we did accidentally run over a lesser prairie chicken nest when we're checking cattle and those sorts of things. There has been a lot of potentially misconceptions and I think misunderstandings about what these plans are and what they aren't, and also who can develop plans and who can't. Basically, anybody who's going to develop a plan must be approved by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service as a developer. The process for that is something we can put a link to that process in the show notes, but basically anybody who wishes to be considered clicks that link, they fill out the application, they talk about, you know, the things that they've done that they think would allow them to write a good plan, and then the Fish and Wildlife Service is going to consider whether or not that person will be approved or not. These plans are not range management plans. They are basically a regulatory requirement to meet the 4D exemption. They have to consider things like soils, past management of that particular parcel, precipitation in the area. Plans need to include measures for dealing with drought and these sorts of things. It's not a prairie chicken grazing plan. It's not a range management plan. It is a plan to meet this 4D exemption. So it's kind of something that we've never dealt with before.
And again, one of the biggest questions is who can assist in plan development? Ricketts explains.
there have been questions about who, from a public agency standpoint, might be available to help develop these plans. Currently, Wildlife and Parks is not considering becoming plan developers. It's possible that could change in the future, but the current plans are not to. NRCS, the Natural Resources Conservation Agency, is currently assessing with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and internally whether or not it makes sense for them to become plan developers. So the caveat to that is that NRCS, within their agency, they've sort of got different duties, right? A range conservationist would have different things that they do. Part of those duties is implementing programs. So that would be implementing things like EQIP, conservation stewardship program, and those sorts of things. If a producer is enrolled in one of those conservation programs, then I've been told that they can have assurance that grazing plans either currently in existence or that will be made in the future under that conservation program will meet the 4D exemption. What they're trying to decide is, should their folks in the field become certified to be plan developers on an individual property basis just for the purpose of developing plans.
Kansas State Wildlife Extension Specialist Drew Ricketts. It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
Before we started these conversations with China, China imported from the world $124 billion in agricultural products.
3 years ago, Greg Dowd was the chief ag negotiator with the U.S. Trade Representative's office.
Last year, that number was $133 billion. This year, if you look at what they're going in and on the trajectory that they're at, I think China will import somewhere in the neighborhood of $141 billion in agricultural products from the world. That's an amazing number, because $141 billion is exactly the same number as total U.S. ag exports to the world last year. So, folks, we live in a world today where China's total imports of ag from the world is the same as the totality of U.S. agricultural exports. Amazing. So when we talk about in the phase one agreement, we're going to take our ag trade with China, the best year ever in 2017 of about $24 billion. We're going to try to take that over, on average, over a couple of years, $80 billion over 2 years, about $40 billion a year. So from 24 to 40. So is that, at first when we had these conversations, everybody went, oh, you guys are all wet. There's no way that that can happen. And they were thinking just soybeans. They didn't understand the structural changes that we've made here, I mean, particularly on the meat side of the equation, but also all these other commodities. I'm going to give you some numbers here in a little bit to help you understand that going from 24 to 40 billion to me is a no-brainer in our trading relationship with China. So let's talk about soybeans for a minute. That's the big kahuna. Keep in mind, in 2017, we sold China about $12 billion in soybeans. Keep in mind, $10 billion of that was done in the fourth quarter of that year. And in fact, if you look at where we're at right now, our new crop year started September 1. We have an all-time record number of sales on the books to China. In fact, if you look at USDA's export projection for soybeans, and Rob Johansson can talk about this, we have over 60% of the crop already sold. That's an all-time record by a country mile. On corn, I hope you appreciate and see what we've done in terms of corn sales with China. It's unprecedented. It's never happened like this before. And there's a very big reason for that. In all of our conversations, and we had some amazing conversations with them on these issues, one of the things that they talked about, and now I think they have implemented, is the banning of swill feeding of hogs in China. You have to understand, half the hogs on the planet are in China, or were before African swine fever. Half of those hogs were fed food scraps, garbage, swill fed. Half. What's going to happen if China does away with that? That's a really interesting conversation, folks, because you have to keep in mind that pigs and chickens are not pigs and chickens in this mind of this Jewell County farm boy who grew up on a hog farm. What are they? They're little walking piles of corn and soybean meal. Right? So comprehend the changes in China as they build more Western-style confinement operations, what are they going to need to do that? They're going to need more corn and soybean meal. One of the things that we are exporting and has reemerged after African swine fever in China is our exports of whey to China are up nearly 50% from a year ago. Why is that, folks? What do you make with whey? Baby pig rations, right? So we're seeing a big change here and what's coming.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
A Wednesday talk about agricultural trade between farm broadcasters and two top U.S. ag trade officials.
Over the past few years, we have seen amazing export numbers for U.S. agriculture. And while challenges and headwinds facing exports do exist, USTR is being proactive about building upon existing and creating new trading relationships across the globe.
While the United States has long been a global leader in food and agricultural exports, as new potential markets emerge, we need to be able to take advantage of those opportunities and bring more U.S. products to all parts of the world.
U.S. Trade Representative's Office Chief Ag Negotiator Doug McCaleb pointed out ag trade wins for our nation in Southeast Asian markets this year, while Agriculture Undersecretary for Trade and Foreign Agricultural Affairs Alexis Taylor covered other farm and food trade gains for the U.S. across the globe in 2023. In Kansas City, I'm Rod Bain reporting.